Again, yesterday our church had a memorial service for Jim, and obviously such services are difficult, but as a pastor, I actually find them the easiest and often best time for me to preach the gospel. I get to share the hope of Jesus Christ with people who are desperately looking for something to cling to in their time of grief. I get to tell them about a promised future in which death and mourning is defeated once and for all. And that's why I often turn to Revelation 21, as I did yesterday, which says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.'" Now, this is a beautiful picture that John's vision has painted for us. But there is one component of the new earth that doesn't make much sense to us. In fact, for some of us, it seems like a little bit of a bummer. The new earth will no longer have any sea. Why would that be a good thing? Well, the Jewish people had a long-standing belief that the sea was a symbol of chaos and evil. I think it's worth exploring that a little bit before we get into our text from Acts this morning, because chapter 27 takes place predominantly on the open water of the Mediterranean. To the average early reader of Acts, this would have meant something much deeper than it does to us. In ancient Near Eastern thought, the sea represented chaos, danger, and forces opposed to God's order. It stood for the untamed, unpredictable, and even demonic parts of creation. Perhaps for that reason, the Jews were largely land people rather than sailors. Yes, there were Jewish fishermen. We've read about those men. But the preferred method of travel for an Israelite was via land, even when it was inconvenient. They even had God split it for them so they could walk through. In the Bible, storms and shipwrecks symbolize human helplessness. However, the sea also functions as a major theater of God's glory and power. He was easily able to subdue the raging waters, and as I said, he was even able to split the sea. So just to be clear for the ocean lovers, none of this means that God is anti-ocean. The new earth not having a sea means the final removal of chaos, evil, and separation. The sea, as the home of monsters and death, will be gone. In this morning's chapter, we will encounter a story that showcases the utterly terrifying and unpredictable nature of the sea. And we will also receive yet another instance in which God is in control even when a situation seems hopeless. I have never been a person that keeps a diary. In the past, I've kept a prayer journal, but I would never really write down much of the events of my life in any sort of detail. Growing up, I probably did that out of a serious fear of my older brother finding that in my room and using it as an endless tool of embarrassment. This morning's text actually reads like a diary entry. More accurately, it reads like a captain's log. Luke, the author of Acts, joined Paul for a harrowing journey, and he kept a detailed account of their voyage. And what we have before us is one of the most accurate ancient travel logs that is in existence today. And so you can turn to Acts 27 and we'll pray as God opens his word for us. Jesus, we pray now that through your Spirit you would speak to us like only you can speak. We ask that by your Spirit you would tune our ears to hear you ever so clearly. We ask you to turn our hearts to you so that we could experience the fullness of all that you have for us. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing and acceptable to you. Be glorified and magnified in this place, Jesus. Amen. Acts 27. Lots of reading today, but I promise you, it is riveting reading. All of Scripture is, except maybe the genealogies. But this is riveting, I promise. When it was decided that we should sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship from Adramidium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so that they might provide for his needs. From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off of Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the town of Lysi. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter, and the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. That's not Arizona. This was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. So we assume that the voyage originated in Caesarea, since that's where we left off in chapter 26. And considering the text is now using we language again, we know that Luke is now back with Paul for the journey to Rome. Aristarchus is also with them. We are told that the Roman commander Julius has been tasked with delivering Paul and other prisoners to Rome. We are also told that Julius has a level of tenderness to him. He was willing to allow Paul a quick respite in Sidon in order to be nurtured and encouraged by some friends there. In addition to these details, we are provided with more than enough information about the early stages of the trip. All I know is that the minutiae all checks out. This is a careful and correct account of the kind of itinerary we would expect at that time. What I want to draw your attention to is the discussion that takes place in Fair Havens. We are told that the Day of Atonement had passed. So that means that they were either in late September or early October. Scholar F.F. Bruce notes that the dangerous season for sailing began about September 14th and lasted until November 11th. And after the latter date, all navigation on the open sea came to an end until winter was over. The seas were closed to sailing until the beginning of February at the earliest. So Paul and the others were smack dab in the middle of dangerous season for sailing. They needed to find a safe place to winter, and Paul argued that they should remain at Fair Havens, but the so-called professional sailors decided it would be best to winter somewhere else. I call them so-called professionals because there is a good chance that Paul was actually a more experienced traveler than them. Nevertheless, the centurion decided to take the risk of moving on in order to winter in a different location. So let's see how that goes for them. Verses 13 through 32. And when a gentle south wind began to blow, they saw their opportunity. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure, so the men hoisted it aboard. Then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together, because they were afraid they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis. They lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourself this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.' On the 14th night, we were all still being driven across the Adriatic Sea when about midnight the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that they would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away." So it's stories like this that make me believe that the book of Acts absolutely could be made into a blockbuster movie. It's high drama, and there are a variety of different characters who play distinct roles. And Paul is the witty leading man who stands confidently in the middle as a hero of epic proportions. You have the scoundrels who were willing to flee to safety and save their own lives at the cost of many others. And you have the good soldiers who end up taking their cues from a prisoner rather than their commanding officer. Growing up in Virginia Beach, it was a common occurrence during the late summer months that we would get hurricane warnings. And most of the people that I knew, we didn't take much, we didn't heed their warnings very much, because rarely did they come to fruition, and even direct hits for that little part of the coast, it didn't do much damage coming from that direction. Now, nor'easters, on the other hand, would wreak havoc on our coastal town. They were those massive winter storms that would come off the coast of Nova Scotia down our east coast, and they would just bring relentless high winds and cold rain. The ship that Paul was on was overwhelmed with a nor'easter. It was a ferocious and long-lasting one that wreaked all sorts of havoc. They tried every strategy at their disposal in order to increase the odds of their survival, but the storm raged on. They no longer had control over their ship. They did not have any way of getting their bearings either. They were completely at the whim of the wind and the waves. And when all hope was lost, Paul stepped forward with a word of encouragement. The encouragement came from the Lord, but in Paul's humanity, he decided to start his speech with a quick and probably unnecessary jab. "If you had listened to me, then none of this would be happening. In other words, I told you so." Right in the middle of it, right? Don't do that, husbands, to your wives. Probably feeling a little pleased with himself, the apostle then went on to share a prophecy. "Listen, everyone. Last night, as the storm raged, an angel from the God to whom I belong and to whom I serve came and stood right beside me, and he said, 'Don't be afraid, Paul. You will stand before Caesar just as God has said. And in his mercy, he's granting the lives of everyone sailing with you. So take heart, men. I believe God. It will happen exactly as he told me. But make no mistake, we're going to run aground on some island. Now, the angelic message was specific. The humans would be safe, but the boat, not so much. That makes it all the more infuriating that when the seasoned sailors began to notice an approach to land, they tried to make a break for it. They didn't want to risk the running aground portion of the prophecy. Paul, sensing their ploy, intervened and declared a new twist on his prediction. If these men leave, then we will not be saved. And this could have just been a common sense statement from Paul, considering the men who were attempting to leave were the professional sailors, the ones who knew how to sail. It would be bad for them to leave, right? But it also could have been a divine decree. God's plans could not be tinkered with by these men. I listened to a Tim Keller sermon on this chapter, and the bulk of it was actually spent discussing the theological significance of this particular section of the story. So let me just give you his key point. Keller asserts that there is a misunderstanding that exists regarding Reformed theology or Calvinism. Some understand it to mean that if things are predestined, then what we do doesn't matter. That is not how this story plays out. If the sailors leave, they will die. Our belief, and yes, it is mind-bendingly mysterious, is that God is 100% in charge, and we are 100% responsible for what we do. God is sovereign, but what we do still matters. Our obedience plays a part in God's plans for our lives. So the sailors need to obey. The soldiers ask no questions of Paul. They quickly cut away the lifeboat and remove any temptation to trust man instead of God. And that all took place in the wee hours of the morning, but now dawn is approaching. So let's read on and see how it ends. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach, where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow struck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely. So first, the sailors, and now the soldiers have been overcome by their fears. That is really what their reactions were rooted in. See, the sailors were afraid to die, so they tried to abandon ship and save their lives. The soldiers were afraid to die too. That is why they were going to kill the prisoners. They were worried about saving themselves. F.F. Bruce explains this for us. According to the traditional Roman discipline, the soldiers were responsible for the safe keeping of the prisoners in their charge. But now it would be easy for the prisoners to escape in the general confusion of abandoning ship. The soldiers, therefore, decided to prevent any such attempt by slaughtering them. Their centurion, however, forbade them to do any such thing. He felt too grateful to Paul to expose him to this fate. "Let the prisoners get safe to land along with the others," he said. The tender-hearted Julius demonstrated humility of character and trust in Paul, which differentiated him from the insecure sailors and soldiers. Ever since he allowed the apostle to have a furlough in Sidon, Luke highlights him as a noble figure. Some commentators even argue that Julius must have been converted to Christianity in order to act the way that he did. Now, we can hope that that is true. We don't know for sure. But regardless, we do know that God chose to use him in his redemptive plan. It isn't until the end of the perilous voyage that Luke tells us the amount of humans spared. 276 made it to shore safely at what is known as St. Paul's Bay in Malta. The supernatural promise had been fulfilled. The chaos of the sea had been overcome, and God set the people back on solid ground. As this sermon comes to a close, I want to point out just a few things. First, I am in awe of the way that Paul stood in the gap for others. Even Luke implies that he had lost hope when he wrote, "We finally gave up all hope of being saved. We." Paul remained steadfast and exercised faith in God on behalf of himself, his fellow believers, pagans, and prisoners. He had no thought of abandoning his mission or the ship. He became the leader of that boat at a time when nobody wanted such a hopeless role. Second, watching how Paul deals with the storm helps us deal with our storms. He turned to God. He gave credit to God, even in that moment of breaking bread in front of them, he gives the credit to God. He demanded obedience to the Lord, who was the Lord regardless of circumstances. Third and finally, a pastoral note. Not all storms of this life will be stilled by God. Tragedies, death, and suffering will inevitably happen. But the promise of the gospel is that when we cling to Jesus, he will grant us peace in the midst of life's battles, and he will carry us on into eternity with him. Now, this morning's passage lends itself perfectly to one hymn. I know many of you know the story behind the writing of it as well, but I am also certain that others do not. In the late 1800s, there was a man named Horatio Spafford. He was a successful lawyer and a devout Christian who lived in Chicago. But in a short span of time, almost like the story of Job, everything in his life fell apart. First, his only son died of scarlet fever. Then the great Chicago fire swept through the city and destroyed most of his business. Still, Spafford and his wife Anna held on to their faith. A couple of years later, they decided to take a trip to Europe with their four daughters to rest and help with a revival that Dwight Moody was leading in England. And at the last minute, Horatio was delayed by business and sent his wife and daughters ahead on an earlier ship. Midway across the Atlantic, the ship collided with another vessel and sank. Over 200 people died, including all four of the Spafford daughters. When Anna reached Wales, she sent a brief telegram to her husband, "Saved alone, what shall I do?" Horatio immediately boarded a ship to join her, and as his own vessel crossed the Atlantic, the captain called him to his cabin and told him they were passing over the very spot where his daughters had perished. And it was there, in that moment of unspeakable loss, that Horatio Spafford penned the words, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll. Whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. So let's stand now and sing together. Stand. Regardless of our circumstances, we can declare that because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, it is well with our souls.